The report of the Committee of Nine, issued in 1974, forecast the Arab oil boycott and subsequent cartelization of Middle East oil supply. The problems of theater defense against new Soviet nuclear armament by Western European countries, and the essential need for a harmonization of their economic and social policies, as well as of their military policies, by the NATO allies. The report of the Committee of Nine also showed the need for effective means to deal with threats to Western Europe's security arising from developments outside the geographical periphery of the NATO alliance, as witness the great crisis in the Middle East. That's one example. Another example of how a senator can use a Senate seat. I served on a United Nations group of eminent persons in 1974 to make recommendations as to how multinational corporations should conduct themselves, especially in developing countries, in respect to their economic and social development. And I carried this through by being responsible in 1965 for the organization of the Adela Investment Company. An example since followed in both Southern Asia and in Africa. To show how these corporations could encourage the transfer of technology, the development of high-level training for local workers, including top executives, and the development of a private enterprise business system in developing countries which were willing to cooperate. Finally, a last example of what senators can do with a Senate seat. In response to the establishment by Japan of the Japan Foundation, with a capital of $100 million to cultivate better cultural relations with the United States, I introduced and got passed a measure to establish a United States-Japan Friendship Commission to be endowed with 10% of the monies paid by Japan to the United States, some $300 million, in connection with the reversion of the island of Okinawa to Japan after World War II. This measure became law on October 20, 1975, and has been effectively implemented since that time with a host of educational projects in colleges and universities of the United States respecting Japanese culture and language, exchanges of musicians and artists and athletes and every other kind of cultural cooperation between Japan and the United States. The lesson taught is that being a senator is more than just being in Washington and voting. To be truly a senator, one has to use one's prestige. in order to forward great causes throughout the world, where the addition of the support of a U.S. senator can become the decisive factor in success or failure to the great benefit of the people of the United States. In connection with the way the U.S. Senate works, the influence on U.S. foreign policy of Senate approval or disapproval of weapons sales, generally a $10 billion per annum business of the United States, is an important historical factor. Recognition by the Senate of this fact has been growing in my time and will continue to grow. For example, the requirements for information of a timely character on weapon sales have been increased materially in the years since 1977, when I first took up this issue in the Foreign Relations Committee. The U.S. Defense Department has been required to divulge its plans for such weapon sales to foreign countries at the beginning of each fiscal year. This is to be contrasted with the previous practice of putting pressure on the Congress through a limited notice period of, say, 30 days respecting such sales, and then the representation by the President that the foreign policy of the nation would be embarrassed if the Congress interposed any delay while it took a harder look at a particular weapons sale. An excellent example of how this kind of deliberation works in this way, giving greater credibility to U.S. foreign policy, is found in my collected papers now available at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. In the case of negotiations for the sale of Hawk missiles, anti-aircraft missiles, to Jordan in 1973, at my behest and that of others, assurances were required by the Congress that Jordan would use these missiles for air defense only and not for offensive purposes against Israel, period, in terms of our thought about it. King Hussein demurred and threatened to buy the missile systems from the Soviet Union. He went to Moscow, in fact, and found the conditions which the Soviet Union would impose impossible. And so he again turned to the United States and accepted the conditions imposed by the United States on the demand of the Congress that the missile systems we sold him be in fixed defensive positions and not mobile, as he wanted them. It was a very salutary lesson for all concerned, and the instruction for the future is that right now, as I speak these words, Jordan is seeking to get mobile missiles, as well as other armament from the United States, And we should learn and instruct our senators and representatives that if you hold out for the conditions which you think are constructive for the peace policy of the United States, you can generally get them. But if you don't show any fight and just let the president run it his way, then it may be run very wrong and unnecessarily wrong as far as the peace policy of the United States is concerned. Just two more now. The Taiwan Relations Act of 1979 is an excellent example of how the Congress may affect the foreign policy of the United States through implementing legislation. When in 1978, December, the end of the year, President Carter first informed the Senate and House leadership and senior members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee, of which I was one, of the prospective normalization of relations with the People's Republic of China, he contemplated continued reliance on the Shanghai communique of the early 70s, which had been issued by President Nixon and Zhou Enlai, then the number two man in the People's Republic of China, as determining the relations between Taiwan and the People's Republic of China. At the meeting in 79, at which President Carter gave us the news of the imminent normalization of relations with the People's Republic of China, Senator Church of Idaho, the then chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and I, as the ranking member of that committee, demurred, period, in terms of the end of that thought. We stated that we felt that the people of Taiwan were entitled to much stronger assurances of their own right to determine their economic and social systems under which they would live under the new circumstances created by the normalization of our relationships with the People's Republic of China, remembering that the Shanghai communique to which I referred stated that there was only one China, thus ultimately establishing some claim to govern Taiwan in the People's Republic of China if we ever, and we did some 6 or 7 years later, normalize relations with the People's Republic of China. And so Senator Church and I insisted that the people of Taiwan were entitled to determine their own economic and social system under the new circumstances. And we suggested to President Carter that we would draft such an implementing law. Senator Church and I proceeded accordingly, and the Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act. Now, what is important for the future because of the efforts of the People's Republic of China to assert its ultimate right to sovereignty over Taiwan which would convert, if it occurred, the making of Taiwan into a Chinese province with all of the problems of a communist system like mainland China now has. And therefore, the historical key to the Taiwan Relations Act is found in Section 3 of that Act, which projects our assurances well into the future. And that section provides, and I quote, "Any threat to the security or the social or economic system of the people on Taiwan may represent a danger to the interests of the United States, and the president is directed to inform the Congress promptly of any such threat," end of quote. I hope very much that in the future the American people will be very jealous of that guarantee of protection, bearing in mind that the fundamental difference between Taiwan and mainland China is the economic and social system, and that if the two are of Taiwan and the people there, and if the two are ever to get together, and I hope they will, that the economic and social system chosen by the 16 million people of Taiwan deserves and should receive the protection, the active protection of the United States and of our people. Okay. Give me the nod. Two of the most important treaties to be put before the Senate for ratification in its post-World War II history were the two Panama Canal treaties, specifically called, one, the Panama Canal Treaty, and two, the Treaty for the Operation and Neutrality of the Panama Canal, both submitted in 1978 for Senate ratification, and the SALT II Treaty to limit the strategic nuclear armaments of the United States and the Soviet Union, submitted to the Senate in 1979. The two Panama Canal treaties were ratified by the Senate with certain reservations, upon which agreement was subsequently secured with the Republic of Panama. And this was a great benefit to our country in peace and in future prospects for peace and tranquility within the Latin American countries, our nearest neighbors. But the SALT II Treaty, though it was favorably reported by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was shelved in the course of the conservative sweep and the election of President Reagan in 1980. The historic significance of these differences in result is that in the case of the two Panama Canal treaties, the United States was given an opportunity for Senate consideration and debate to sustain its policy of a good neighbor and a good partner, which is so essential to the security of the United States and the other countries of the Western Hemisphere. And this result, though there were great difficulties, was accomplished because the Senate adopted a series of reservations to the Panama Canal treaties, which were then settled and negotiated satisfactorily with the Republic of Panama. On the contrary, we must learn from these events the colossal mistake respecting SALT II and why it was shelved, and how harmful that is to the United States. In the latter case of SALT II, its determined opponents succeeded in preventing the Senate consideration of the treaty at all, and the adoption of reservations which had been agreed on by the Foreign Relations Committee and might or might not have been agreed on in the Senate, but without any question, a series of reservations would have been added before the Senate ratified the SALT II Treaty. And even though many of those reservations might have been opposed by the proponents of the SALT II Treaty, like myself, it still would have been better than leaving all the issues covered by the treaty wide open. And in my estimation, the difference would have been between negotiating the reservations to SALT II put on by the Senate over a period of maybe 2 years with the Soviet Union instead of the policy we adopted of shelving the whole SALT II treaty, which in my judgment will result in perhaps as much as 7 years of negotiation with the Soviet Union before we get any treaty limiting nuclear armaments like SALT II, or it may be called when it finally comes, hopefully, SALT III. And our situation has not been helped by the declaration of the Republican National Platform in 1980 that the United States seeks, quote, superiority, end of quote, in strategic nuclear armament, and a very dangerous situation has been developed in the nuclear arms competition between the U.S. and the USSR as a result, because obviously superiority in nuclear armaments would be impossible. The Russians just won't let it happen, nor are we likely to finance it. And the only result has been to put negotiations under the assurance of years instead of months to negotiate with the Soviet Union on another limitation of nuclear armaments, which we could have done so well had we adopted the course which I and other proponents recommended under SALT II, and allowed the Senate to consider the treaty instead of not considering, opposing any reservations which it would care to adopt, or rather containing and not opposing any reservations which the Senate would care to adopt, period, in terms of the whole story. I can only hope that the extension of this period for negotiating some final further treaty with the Soviet Union on the limitation of strategic nuclear armaments which in my opinion has been extended by these events for as much as 5 years, will not prove to be a disaster for all concerned. And to urge our people not to make that same mistake again, should we be able to negotiate some additional limitation on strategic nuclear armaments with the Soviet Union in the coming years. Okay. And that they're of inestimable importance to labor. And I doubt that anyone else will do what I have done. And I hope very much, therefore, that you will evaluate for its news value my speech rather than latch on to some, you know, big catchy issue which is here today and will be gone tomorrow. That said, I really hope very much you will do that out of sheer respect for this organization. But I realize, as I say, that the pressure is on you to get something from me on this subject. So let me just say, I'm sure all of you would understand that it would be unthinkable to me that there is any such thing as a Jewish seat from New York in the Senate, or that any group, any ethnicity, any religious faith has any right to anything like that. Or nor that there is any such tradition. The people of the state, I hope, perhaps I say with some feeling, feel they have chosen the best in 4 previous Senate elections. I hope they still feel the same way. And that will be their privilege. I have offered myself to them, and I've made it very clear that I'm campaigning and will bear the burden of proof as if this were the first election, with one exception, and that is that they know now whether I do or don't, and I believe I very much do, try to keep my promises, and that they're just not, quote, campaign promises, and on much I've delivered. Other than that, there's really nothing I wish to say about
it. Do you disagree with the governor in referring to this as historically, traditionally, a Jewish seat?
I do not wish to take any issue with Governor Kerry. I have said it is not a Jewish seat, it is not a Christian seat, it is not a seat of any ethnicity. It is a Senate seat to which the people must elect that person, man or woman, whom they would consider the most likely to represent them effectively and truly and with integrity. I believe I am that person. That's up to them to change.
You regret the governor having raised this question?
That's up to, I can't.
Well, but if you regret it, you can say so.
I don't have to do that because I don't want to get into a big hassle about that subject. I would not have said it. I never have. And I've been there a lot longer than anybody else. For 24 years, nobody has ever heard me utter any such thought, let alone word, and it's certainly nothing I would ever think of doing, period.
Does it reflect traditional, old-fashioned kind of political
thing? No, it doesn't reflect any tradition at all. It is a happenstance that Lehman and I have served in this seat. And I have been a senator for 24 years, which immediately makes it a long time because of me. And I know I was not elected because of my faith. I was elected because, in my judgment, the people thought that I was the best representative. And they continued to think so through 4 elections, and I hope they will for a fifth.
Senator, the governor was saying today when he was here that he was talking more philosophically than about religion, and he spoke of having that seat be strongly supported of Israel.
I again repeat, sir, I want to get into no differences with the governor. I have stated my position, period.
Senator, do you think this could have possibly any negative backlash on your campaign?
I have no comment on that. The people will judge.
I believe the people of New York are very sensible and intelligent people, and they will only charge me with what I say.
Senator, do you think you're backing Ronald Reagan for election? Are you feeling less comfortable with your support for him after the China debacle, if you will?
No, I wouldn't call it a debacle, but I feel that Governor Reagan has a lot that he's going to find out about this job. And just to take an example of Taiwan, there is a liaison office, if you want to call it that. It's working very effectively and efficiently, and it's provided by the Taiwan Relations Act, of which I, with Senator Church of Idaho, was the author. So I know a little about it, and it is the right way to go. And I believe that Governor Reagan also will come to that conclusion in due time.
Do you think he was shooting from the mouth here?
I cannot make any such comment. I just tell you that I think that given a little time, he too will come to the same conclusion.
Would you agree with Mr. Mondale that he is confused, misinformed, and that he is...
No, I don't think so. I think that, that the presidential nomination is a big thing, and there are some things you have to catch up with, and maybe that's one of them.
Do you think a Reagan administration would be supportive of the things you talked about here today?
I think a Reagan administration will be supportive of some of them, and not of others. But that never made any difference to me when the president was a Democrat or a Republican. I had many differences, even with a man I loved and revered, Dwight Eisenhower, on civil rights, for example. So this is not an unusual position for me. If anything, I can be even more useful within that frame of reference because I'm a balance wheel for my party, and I'm a sincere and unprejudiced critic for the other party.
Senator, today Ray Corbett told the delegates here that...
And by the way, and one of the things my opponent is now throwing up to me is that it's wrong to call them as you see them. If I see them the way the president does in a given case, I never hesitate to vote that way because I'm a Republican and he's a Democrat. That's not the way I think high-level politics can be run.
Senator Ray Corbett told the delegates today that he considered Ronald Reagan to be the greatest threat to the labor movement in modern times. If a delegate here asked you why shouldn't they vote for Jimmy Carter's administration, what would you tell them?
I would tell them that on the presidential, in view of the fact that they're going to endorse me, I will not embarrass him with my advice.
Senator, in your talk you said that the old doctrines of free trade must give way to the doctrine of fair trade. This implies...
I didn't say the old rotten doctrine.
No, the old doctrine.
Old doctrine.
This implies that you support more restrictions on
imports.
Can you spell it out a little
bit? Oh, yes, I can spell it out for you exactly. I made it very clear. I believe that the anti-dumping laws have to be enforced, especially at this time when we have such serious unemployment in our own country. And second, I believe that we must make agreements with other countries and pass laws if we have to, which will prevent the extinction of a business or its substantial impairment of an industry by a sudden incursion of imports. We have had some cases in which imports increased by 150 or 200% within one trading year, which can put anybody out of business before they can adjust. And that is a proper case.